Hello, I am Eli Adachi, Professor of Medical Science at Brown University and host of Medscape One-on-One. Joining me today is Senator Richard Blumenthal, the junior senator from the state of Connecticut. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to have you on this program.
I'm honored to be on the program. Thank you.
As a seasoned legislator and a former attorney general, how do you think about the outcome of the Supreme Court deliberations as they relate particularly to the individual mandate of the Affordable Care Act? I know you have given it significant thought. What can you tell our viewers?
I think the law is on the side of upholding the Affordable Care Act. The precedent would dictate saying that it is constitutional. First of all, you know, there's a very strong presumption in favor of any law that Congress passes. Second, on the Commerce Clause issue, there is a lot of strong precedent in favor of upholding the law. Mm-hmm. Not to say that's the outcome that will happen, but I think that the idea of upholding the law is one that is deeply rooted in the jurisprudence that exists right now. And I think that there's a strong case to be made. Yes. Whether the government's made it sufficiently strongly remains to be seen.
And you would argue that that argument holds both for the individual mandate and for the expansion of Medicaid in terms of the ability or the desirability of the court upholding the law.
Again, the court is not in the position, should not be in the position of deciding whether it's a good law or a bad law, whether it's good policy or bad policy. The court is deciding whether constitutionally it is so abhorrent, so contrary to existing principle, mm-hmm. that it must be struck down. There's a strong presumption in favor of upholding the law in any congressional legislation or any state law. And so I think that on the individual mandate and on the question of whether that mandate is, yes. separable, whether the law can be upheld if it is struck down, there's a strong presumption in favor of upholding. Again, the questions the court asks are always given some weight by the public that observes it, but in a way, and I've argued four times, and I've...
Before the Supreme Court.
Before the Supreme Court, as before many other appellate, mm-hmm. courts, mm-hmm. I'm always impressed by how little connection there is between the questions and the ultimate outcome.
This may be premature, but assuming for the moment that the court overturns the Affordable Care Act, in part or in whole, have you and your colleagues given any thought to what might fill that void?
Well, you know, let me begin, because you asked me about my personal experience, with some reflections about how that experience informs my views,
yes,
on the Affordable Care Act.
It is rare that we have a former attorney general on this program.
There are only a few of us in the Congress. But as attorney general, what I saw repeatedly was the abuses by the insurance companies, whether on pre-existing conditions or establishing, mm-hmm. lifetime or annual caps, or simply refusing to cover a procedure because it was supposedly experimental, mm-hmm. or a doctor was outside the network. This law has eliminated many of those abuses. And my hope is, whatever the outcome in the United States Supreme Court, that insurance companies continue to follow the moral imperatives that underlie those legal mandates, and including the requirement that they cover young adults up to the age of 26 years old on existing, mm-hmm. policies. I think that's a very important public policy outcome of the law, and many insurance companies actually favored it when it was before the Congress. I hope they continue to follow it. Second, what I saw as Attorney General is waste and fraud in the system. There's an estimate that it's $70 billion annually, fraud alone. And the recoveries under Medicare fraud are in the range of about $4 billion a year. So I think we're just capturing or recovering a fraction of the waste and fraud in the system. And I recovered literally millions of dollars as Attorney General through lawsuits under Medicare and Medicaid fraud. I think there's much more to be done in that area. And third, what I saw overwhelmingly, and I think all providers recognize it, is the excessive increases in the costs of health care. We need to control the costs of health care, not by eliminating quality or even reducing quality, but in fact, I think that improving quality can be achieved as a goal of reducing some of the unnecessary costs. And of course, those include hospital-acquired conditions, such as infections, premature discharges from hospital. You know, one of the most telling statistics to me is that Medicare patients are readmitted at a rate of 25% within 30 days of their discharge. Think of it. 30 days, 25% go back into the hospital. Enormous costs that we need to winnow out of that system. So I think there are lots of ways. The president's proposed some partnerships for patients, affordable care organizations, accountable care organizations. Those are mechanisms to achieve reductions in the inflation rate in healthcare. And, you know, I think that a lot of the providers, the most responsible docs and hospitals, are all very firmly united in this cause.
Speaking of cost reduction and knowing your earlier actions on behalf of the elderly, I want to turn to Medicare for just a minute. As you well know, the House of Representatives, led by Congressman Paul Ryan, has proposed its plan to reform Medicare, very distinct from the plan enunciated by the administration through the Affordable Care Act. What are your thoughts or views with respect to the main tenets, at least, of the Ryan proposal?
I strongly disagree with the Ryan proposal. First, because it would shift costs to seniors. The estimate is, in Connecticut alone, $6,500 would be increased in out-of-pocket costs for seniors. It would decimate Medicare as we know it. Second, it would block grant the Medicaid program, which would very severely harm Connecticut and many other states that are generous, to use a loaded term, but it is true, to our seniors and the dual eligibles, but also to Medicaid patients, the ones who can least afford care. And I think that the idea of establishing caps on the rate of inflation, both the president and Ryan say it should be the rate of inflation, should be the rate of increases should be no more than the increases in GDP plus 1%. Fine as a goal. The question is how to achieve it. The president's proposed mechanisms, like the partnership for patients, which would increase the incentives for cutting the costs and increasing costs of health care by reducing hospital-acquired infections and other kinds of costs that I think we can address and cut. And it really enlists the medical community in that effort in a very constructive way. Rather than the slashing across-the-board cuts, possibly in provider reimbursements, which further discourages providers from being a part of the Medicare program. And so I think there are really very constructive ways to approach cutting costs of health care, cutting the rate of inflation in health care costs, without the Ryan slashing across-the-board cuts, which in many respects are unspecific and unspecified.
I wanted for a moment to come back to the issue of waste and fraud, which I agree with you should be high on the agenda. As you know, just last week, Attorney General Holder and Secretary Sebelius announced the arrest of about 100 individuals who allegedly submitted false claims to the tune of perhaps $500 million. Clearly, if the estimate is $70 billion a year or thereabouts, from your experience as Attorney General, as an enforcer in a sense, what else can we do to improve the recovery or improve the enforcement of the law?
That's an excellent question. And I think we're really on the cusp of some very important preventive devices. And as you know, information technology mm-hmm. not only enables avoidance of mistakes in prescriptions, a lot of mistakes like misprescriptions are the result of, forgive me, doctor handwriting. I can say that because my brother's a doctor. He has better handwriting than I do. But still, mistakes can result from handwritten prescriptions. Information technology enables avoidance of mistakes, but also prevention of fraud. Mm-hmm. Because, and I was one of the advocates in Connecticut of an information technology system that prevents patients from gaming the system. And this is just one example, but it is an important example of patients doctor shopping and making the docs, in a sense, victims of their own generosity. A patient who is addicted to a painkiller wants to doctor shop, can submit numerous requests, mm-hmm. and the doctor advertently or inadvertently mm-hmm. can be drawn into that mm-hmm. system. So I think that information collection, registries of patients, that kind of real-time submission of information sounds like a really technical, complex thing, but actually it is very feasible and cost-effective to prevent fraud and waste in the system. Using information technology more and more, I think, is one means of doing it. And I say that as a law enforcement official. Yes. You're absolutely right. That's what I did for a living for 20 years and went after a lot of corrupt patients, for lack of a better term, who were gaming the system, maybe needed treatment for the addiction, and instead were using the doctors as an accomplice, so to speak.
Yeah. I want to switch gears somewhat to a very different topic, albeit related. As you well know, the Physician Payment Sunshine Act is to go into effect early next year. This is a component of the Affordable Care Act that is finally being implemented. Can you say something for the benefit of our viewers about the significance of this development, and whether or not you are satisfied with its implementation?
I think its implementation is still a work in progress. And quite honestly, I would welcome criticism from doctors and providers yes. who are involved, hospitals who have direct experience. Mm-hmm. And what's most important, and I should emphasize mm-hmm. that this statement applies to every answer I've given so far. We need to listen to the people who are affected, mm-hmm. particularly the providers and the doctors and technicians and hospital administrators. That's really what I try to do. When I go back to Connecticut, and I go back every weekend, I speak to the heads of hospitals and I go to visit them. Mm-hmm. I have spent a lot of time in Bridgeport Hospital and St. Vincent's in Bridgeport learning about what they do, Yale New Haven, which is mm-hmm. a tremendous resource, Hartford Hospitals and Greenwich Hospital, all of these hospitals, Danbury, mm-hmm. are really working hard, as are most of the doctors, to control the cost of healthcare without reducing quality, in fact, to increase quality. So when I talk about these issues like eliminating waste and fraud, I regard the doctors and the professionals as partners in this effort, not by any means adversaries, and so too yes. with the Sunshine payment provisions. I think it's very much a work in progress, and we need to use more disclosure, transparency to help us frame improvements in the law.
Another concern of our viewers inevitably is the issue of medical liability reform. And as you probably know, in your own state, last week, the House of Representatives turned down a bill that would have facilitated the filing of malpractice lawsuits. One question that often comes up has to do with whether or not we should be thinking about this issue as a state issue or whether a more systemic, perhaps federal solution is called for. And given your background yet again, I think our viewers would be the beneficiaries of your insights.
One of the important advances in the Affordable Care Act is to establish some test programs, for lack of a better word, prototypes to experiment.
Demonstration projects.
Yeah. And demonstration projects that will yield more information about
right.
what can be done to improve the system now. I think there needs to be some federal leadership in this area. Mm-hmm. Perhaps these issues should not be left to a state-by-state mm-hmm. patchwork, but as you know, the tradition is for states to regulate their own legal system, mm-hmm. set their own laws in this mm-hmm. area so far as negligence mm-hmm. and malpractice is concerned. So I think there'll be inevitably some tension between those two needs or traditions. Mm-hmm. And I think it's an area that we need to address more effectively. And Connecticut decided not to adopt a new law.
Right.
You know, sometimes the legislature follows the old edict, first do no harm. And I think that's very much the approach that we need to take in this area.
Last month, you introduced the Patient Safety and Generic Labeling Improvement Act, thereby providing recourse to consumers who might be injured by generic drugs. What prompted you to tackle this issue, other than for your long track record as a consumer advocate? But specifically, what prompted you to tackle this matter, and how is this law going to address the issue in a way?
First, as a consumer advocate, I want to make sure that patients have a say. Obviously, doctors know
yes.
the advantages medically and can advise patients, but patients should know the upsides and the disadvantages of yes. generics when they're prescribed so that they can make intelligent decisions and also evaluate the costs, whether they want to pay out-of-pocket additional costs for brand-name drugs, what kinds of options are available. I think there needs to be full range of advice. But I think the same is true in other areas as well. You know, I've proposed protections relating to medical devices, to drug shortages. As I go around the state of Connecticut and as I hear from, for example, anesthesiologists around the country, drug shortages are a very important issue, a crisis issue. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason we have drug shortages, I'm told, is because many of them are generics, and maybe the profit motive isn't there. They're sterile injectables, which also are often generics. And so I think as we go into an era where patents are expiring, there'll be more genetics on the market, we need to understand and enable patients to understand what the upsides and the disadvantages are.
Finally, and perhaps on a more personal note, I couldn't help but observe how, in your previous positions, you have battled big tobacco, big pharma, and other interests on behalf of consumers, which led me to say earlier something about your track record in consumer advocacy. Would you share with our viewers what was it about that particular line of pursuit that you found yourself so aggressively involved with? What led you to it and therefore, in a way, highlighted your public service?
I think a lot of my motivation as Attorney General was to fight for people who needed an advocate, often when they had no place else to turn in the medical area. I've tried to continue that advocacy, for example, on medical devices. Mm-hmm. I have proposed a measure, which will be part of the FDA reauthorization, that provides for post-market surveillance of implants, for example, hip implants or knee replacements, when they fail, giving people a recourse, and the FDA a means of enforcement. On drug shortages, I really think notification is very, very important, because these are workhorse medicines in desperately short supply, and there are overcharges, a gray market, that increase the cost of medical care, sometimes on these drugs, by 800%, 1,000%. Again, a consumer issue that is fortunately remedied in the FDA reauthorization bill. I hope it will pass. We need it to pass so that the FDA will continue to be in existence, and these measures are part of it. So I'm continuing to fight for patients, but also seeking to serve the needs of patients through their doctors. I have a very important principle in the medical area. Decisions should be made by doctors and patients working together without the interference of big insurance companies, big pharmaceutical drug companies, government. The Attorney General or the U.S. Senator should not be telling patients what decisions to make. That ought to be a matter that the patient decides in consultation with a doctor or family. And that's true, by the way, of contraceptive care, of decisions on a whole range of medical issues. But that's been the reason why I've been a champion. I hope I can call myself a champion of consumer interests, because in the medical area, those decisions ought to be very private, and they should be made by the patients and the doctors and families, not by big institutions like insurance companies or government or pharmaceutical drug companies.
Well, there's so much more we could talk about. All I would say is keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
And thank you on behalf of our viewers. On this note, sincere thanks to Senator Blumenthal and to you, our viewers, for joining Medscape One-on-One. Until next time, I am Eli Adashi.